The U.S. is covertly sponsoring Daesh terrorists. That is a claim that Moscow has made when it comes to the Daesh in Afghanistan. But why would the U.S. do that? Russia says the U.S. wants to take revenge on the Taliban for its defeat. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether our guests agree on this stance by Russia. We'll also take a look at other instances of U.S. support for Daesh terrorists and what gains the U.S. was looking for with this association, which, based on its track record, has not been anything substantial. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, who joins us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. Daniel Kovalik, first over to you. So the U.S. reaching out to armed groups that oppose the Taliban and also secretly giving money to Daesh, that is what Russia's presidential envoy for Afghanistan has said. What do you think?
Well, I mean, why would anybody be surprised by this? The U.S., of course, was the one that supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, beginning actually in mid-1979, before the Soviet Union had a presence there. And, of course, the Mujahideen was a jihadist terrorist group. One of its leaders, of course, was Osama bin Laden, who went on to form al-Qaeda. So the U.S. has been working with terrorist groups, certainly as far back as the 80s. And since then, we know that the U.S. and NATO, you know, partnered with jihadists in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi. They then helped those same jihadists in Libya to travel to Syria to try to overthrow Assad. And the U.S. supported jihadists in Syria against Assad. So this is really par for the course for the United States.
Okay, this is where, Fra Hughes, we need to have you help us or help the ones who are not a believer of this or who do not accept this association between the U.S. and terrorist groups as to how that does happen. Because Daniel Kovalik talked about how it supported jihadists in Libya, then jihadists in Syria. His word was jihadist. We call them terrorists. As to how the U.S. Has done this and why it has done this and why did it resort to the terrorist formula as it saw?
Well, firstly, if you take a look at American history, I mean, America claims to have got its freedom from the British Empire in 1776. And then for 225 years out of 247 years of American modern history as an independent state, America has been at war with its neighbors or somewhere else within the globe. So the American administration and the people behind these wars and the bankers for 225 years have been profiteering from war and profiting from the misery and the death and the maimings that they bring to other sovereign nations. I mean, you could even throw Ukraine into this. I mean, a lot of people believe it's a proxy war. The Americans are going to fight to the last drop of Ukrainian blood in order to destabilize Russia. So if we take that as the most recent example and just move backwards, we can see that America uses proxy armies in order to carry out its dirty work when it's frightened to get its own boots on the ground. Indeed, there were instances in Syria where the Americans supposedly were dropping arms to their allies within Syria, which unfortunately and kind of uncontrollably fell into the path of Daesh. And the Syrian army has claimed before that their positions have been attacked by American forces prior to Daesh ISIS assaults on their positions. So, you know, there is a history of this. There is a history of the proxy wars where the American administration uses other people to carry out their fights. And one other example would be when America and its allies invaded Iraq. It was about 6 months after the invasion of Iraq that we began to witness the bombings of the various mosques. Now, to my mind, that was used by America and especially Britain in order to sow division and civil war within Iraq, while Iraqis were fighting each other they were not fighting the occupation. Sure. And I think America wants to see Afghanistan to continue to be disabled because it's on the borders with Iran. And you never know who they could try and bring to power as a pro-Western puppet regime in the future.
Yeah, we're going to discuss some of those examples in greater detail and maybe even more examples of this U.S. Association with these terrorists in one form or another. Going back to what the Russian envoy has said, and this is pretty interesting, Daniel Kovalik, he has said the Americans have been acting this way, quote, because they really want to avenge their shameful military political defeat in Afghanistan, and in retaliation, they do everything so that peace is not established in this troubled land. Now, I'm curious as to how this can be understood. I mean, it wasn't bad enough that they occupied the land for over 20 years. It wasn't bad enough that nothing that they promised really panned out. But now that they have pulled out and left the country in tatters, they wanted to destroy it more by supporting this group? I mean, are they supporting then by default these terrorists that are bombing instances where we know that it has led to many civilian deaths?
Well, yes, I think that is probably the case. And again, this seems to be the current modus operandi of the United States in its foreign policy, particularly in West Asia. When you look at the wreckage that the U.S. and NATO have left behind in a place like Libya, which was a very stable country under Gaddafi, very prosperous. Of course, the U.S. and NATO bombed that country to smithereens, left it broken. Now there's slaves being sold in public markets. Libya may never be restored to a stable country. The same can be said of Iraq. The same can be said of Afghanistan itself. It seems that actually destruction is the goal many times. And why would that be? I don't think it's purely out of spite, though in the case of Afghanistan, there was probably some of that. But it's because the U.S. has decided that it's easier to rule and to exploit other people's resources and labor if there's no unified, stable state that governs, right? I think another example of this is the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the U.S. has supported proxies as well for many years, which have gone in and killed literally millions of Congolese, but again, to maintain instability in that country so that the West can just, plunder the resources there without limit, without having to pay taxes. I think that's what we're seeing. That is U.S. foreign policy.
In the case of Afghanistan, however, just as a segue here, that Farah Hughes, it appears that the U.S. would have a lot to actually benefit when it has an unstable Afghanistan, given the fact that you have this Russian envoy stating what it has in terms of the U.S. terrorist connection, because you have, on the one hand, Iran on the one side, and then you have China. You have also Russia, in a sense, where the Russian envoy has actually blamed the U.S. also for wanting to support this because it wants to go after Russia. So the U.S. Can benefit from this association when it comes to three of its, whatever you want to call them, arch foes or what have you. In this case in point, Afghanistan's destabilization through these terrorists can be a way for the U.S. to get to these countries. Is that one or a correct way of looking at this?
I'm not sure. I would say that there's definitely possibilities for further destabilization of Iran, depending on what parts of the country Daesh in Afghanistan could possibly control with the armaments and the finances coming through from America. But America claimed it attacked Afghanistan because of 9/11. But when they put in their puppet president, Mohammad Karzai, at the very beginning, the first actual kind of presidential decree he signed, I believe, was an order to allow a gas pipeline to travel through Afghanistan. That may have been previously banned or not the case under a previous regime. I agree. I don't think it's about revenge. America cares nothing about Afghanistan or the Afghan people. I believe when they pulled out, they were purely pivoting towards China. So they've withdrawn their forces in Afghanistan in order to regroup both for Ukraine and for any forthcoming kind of action against or to China. So I think that's why they left. I mean, America could have stayed on in Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban had the countryside, but the allies and the Americans had the cities. So they could have just stayed in perpetuity with a low-level war in order to plunder the resources of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But I think they have, you know, they have their chess pieces on the global board. And if we look even further back, you know, when America was focused on Latin America, we had dictators and people that were supported brutal dictatorships, brutal right-wing fascist regimes that tortured and murdered and disappeared their own citizens. That was all with the backing of America. So America, as it changes its foreign policy, following its, you know, its eye on where it's looking to exploit next, then that's why we have seen the war in Ukraine, the wars in West Asia, and potential wars going forward with a potential proxy with Taiwan and Japan against China. So it's a very dangerous, very sinister campaign that that the American administration is following.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, and Danny Kovalik, when we first started out, you talked about the statements made by the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in terms of the Mujahideen, I think is what you said. And interestingly, in some sense, back in 2014, the former U.S. President Barack Obama hosted a two-day strategy meeting. I'm looking at this one particular case in point, where he met with the intelligence chiefs of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan, and some other Middle Eastern countries. And what the purpose of that meeting was, this two-day security meeting, was to refocus military aid away from the al-Nusra Front and, well, they call it ISIS, we call them Daesh, towards more moderate groups of what they called rebels. So when you take a look at the type of involvement with these terrorist groups through its allies, okay, we're seeing an extensive penetration that they had, not penetration, connection that they had with these groups in a variety of levels and based on a variety of different terrorist groups. And of course, that was 9 years ago, back in 2014. These types of relationships have been going on for quite some time, right?
Well, yeah, and I believe it was in 2014 that Joseph Biden, then vice president, said that there were no moderate rebels in Syria, and that therefore the rebels we were supporting were not moderate, meaning they were in fact the very terrorists we claimed we were fighting against. In fact, that could be said about the Free Syrian Army, which the U.S. openly supported for a time, and which committed terrorist acts in Syria, including trying to destroy Christian churches in cities like Malula and Homs and elsewhere. So, yeah, I mean, we know for sure that the support for those types of groups goes back that far and even farther. You know, Seymour Hersh, who won the Pulitzer Prize, a great Western journalist, he wrote an article back in, I want to say, 2007, maybe, saying that even by like 2005, George W. Bush had pivoted away from fighting terrorism to actually at times partnering with terrorists to try to weak in Syria, weak in Iran. And let's remember, the U.S. Has supported the MEK over time, the MEK being a terrorist group that's killed tens of thousands of Iranian civilians. So, again, nothing is surprising about this. This is par for the course. The sad part is that few Americans realize it, but the truth is out there. And again, there's many officials in the U.S. government who at times have admitted this.
Sad part, I think, sadder even than that, is the fact that we here in the Islamic Republic are being labeled as terrorists. Not we, but the government. That's a whole other topic for another Spotlight program. Okay, so the U.S., Frahues, has a base in Syria. Not far from it, there are terrorists that are there. And for years now, even though it's illegally occupying that part of Syrian territory, it's been saying that it's there to eradicate terrorists. Why doesn't it get rid of the terrorists there? Why is it that, for example, Russia has said that the Al-Tanf military base, terrorists are roaming freely around in that area, and also has accused the U.S. of training some of these terrorists? What do you think of those statements from Russia?
Firstly, I'd have to say I've always been very impressed by the spokespeople that the Russian government has fronting their foreign policy. They seem to be people of integrity, people of honor, and people of honesty, and who refreshingly appear to tell the truth and paint the picture as it's seen on the ground in Syria and Ukraine and Afghanistan and anywhere they choose to see what's happening under kind of Western imperialism. I believe fully that America will be training the Daesh terrorists in Syria. They're still there stealing the wheat of the Syrian people. They're still there stealing the oil. So we're back to the wars for profit that continually seems to be the background to these conflicts. I would fully believe that America is not only training and arming and financing Daesh in Syria, but I would be fairly convinced that they are directing them. The only ointment in the eye here at the moment appears to be Turkey's growing fraternal relationship with Syria and Russia, and it's distancing itself from America, and perhaps it's going to join the new kind of Belt and Road initiative, the new Silk Road, to bring more prosperity and more jobs to Turkey. So I believe the Russians, and I would believe them a lot sooner than I would ever believe one word of a British, European, or American politician or spokesperson.
Let's go back to the year 2012. I know it's a long time ago, Daniel Kovalik, but I'm wondering if you remember this. This was a case that went to trial in London of a Swedish man that was accused of terrorism in Syria. Again, I don't know if you recall that. And you have this man being tried in court, and then all of a sudden, it's not all of a sudden, but then it became clear that the courts were not aware that British intelligence had actually been arming the terrorists that that defendant was charged with. I don't know if you remember that. It was quite a case where later on, based on a particular source, reports were cited that MI6 had cooperated with the CIA on a rat line, as it was called, of arms transfers from Libyan stockpiles to the Syrian terrorists. So that's a clear case in point of how you have different intels of the countries, in this case the U.S. and the U.K., cooperating together to arm terrorists. I know this is, again, old news, but don't you think this serves as a clear case in point of U.S. and, of course, the U.K. Support behind terrorists?
Well, yes, and I don't remember that particular case, but what I do remember is, again, another Seymour Hersh article called Red Lines and Rat Lines about the very phenomenon you were talking about the U.K. and the U.S. Supporting terrorists in Syria. And by the way, Seymour Hersh really, after writing that, had a hard time getting published anywhere because no one in the West wanted to hear the truth about that. The other thing in 2012 was that the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, I believe, they had a classified document that somehow was leaked that, again, admitted that the U.S. was supporting groups in Syria whose intentions were to set up a caliphate in Syria. And so, again, all these things are pretty evident that that the U.S. has been secretly supporting these groups for many years.
The question that comes to mind here, it's a very simple question, Frau Hughes, and forgive me if I'm asking this, but why does the U.S. have to subscribe to terrorists? Why doesn't it just go after who it wants to go after, which it does, through its own army? Is it that incapable that it has to subscribe to terrorists?
I think it's possibly cheaper to use someone else. If you remember the Vietnam War with so many American casualties that the American people eventually turned against the administration and demanded that their troops be brought home, that hasn't happened in recent conflicts because we saw shock and awe. What you've actually seen is the America as the number one superpower, having, you know, such a tactical advantage on the rest of the world. I mean, attacking Afghanistan and attacking Iraq and Libya and Syria, these are countries that could not possibly militarily stand up to America. But I do believe it's easier to try and install a proxy government. It's easier to pay other people to do the dirty work and do the fighting. And rather than put a huge amount of American boots on the ground and therefore kind of exposing them to potential attack by, you know, a revolutionary army of national liberation. I mean, when you create Daesh, I believe America created that with Saudi Arabia. So it was, you know, Saudi tech fury, fanatical kind of fundamentalist Islamists. We are following the wrong path in Islam by following the route of terrorism. I mean, they were financed by Saudi Arabia and they were backed by America, and Turkey allowed them to enter into Syria. So there's a little triumvirate there that allowed this war on Syria to take place. So it's easy for the American Congress to vote, you know, to give money to the military budget, and then the black hole that appears in the CIA accountability of those finances and the Pentagon and stuff, they can just run off, buy arms, buy weapons, buy mercenaries, because that's what Daesh is. It's a mercenary army paid for by America and Saudi Arabia. And when you think of the likes of the White Helmets, they were the kind of propaganda wing for Daesh in Syria. I mean, they were started by an ex-MI6 operative, and they were backed by millions of dollars from Britain and from Canada and from America in order to promote the propaganda that they were using around chemical warfare and the barrel bombs that were just supposed to destroy hospitals in Syria. So, you know, if I had the money, I wouldn't go and fight my enemy. I'd probably pay someone else to do it and keep myself safe.
Okay, so the final question goes to you, Daniel Kovalik. Iran has always said that, you know, when you have the foreign countries and their armies in one form or another in this particular region of West Asia, and this is in direct reference to the U.S., that you're going to have these types of activities still prosper in some sense, or still to ongo, to continue, that is. And of course, the association that we have made in this program of the U.S. with the Daesh terrorists is still one source of instability, which Iran says that the U.S. needs to go. Are we looking at the fact that if the U.S. was to leave the region, that these terrorists would cease to exist?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the sad part, the sad truth is that once you create such monsters, they tend to have a life of their own. We saw that, again, with the Mujahideen, which morphed into Al-Qaeda, which then went on to attack the United States. I don't think that was the plan. I mean, there's a lot of unintended consequences from all this. Now, you'd hope that eventually those things would fizzle out. But again, you know, the U.S. has created monsters that it set loose on the world. And once that happens, it may be hard to control and stop them. And that, again, that is one of the great tragedies of all this.
Thank you very much for that. Daniel Kovalik, Professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law from Pittsburgh, PA. Farah Hughes, thank you. Journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatway and the team, it's goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of Chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Brothers and sisters, let's now listen to these verses, 146th up until 150th verse. أَتُتْرَكُونَ فِي مَا هَا هُنَا
آمِنِينَ. Will you be left in what is here, secure from death?
فِي جَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونٍ.
Within gardens and springs.
وَزُرُوعٍ وَنَخْلٍ طَلْعُهَا هَضِيمٍ.
And fields of crops and palm trees with softened fruit.
أَتُتْرَكُونَ فِي مَا هَا هُنَا آمِنِينَ فِي جَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونٍ وَزُرُوعٍ وَنَخْلٍ طَلْعُهَا هَضِيمٍ. Will you be left secure in the enjoyment of all that you have here, فِي جَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونٍ, in the gardens and springs, وَزُرُوعٍ وَنَخْلٍ طَلْعُهَا هَضِيمٍ, and the cornfields and date palms with slender spathes? As you were previously with us, we started this section of chapter Shu'ara, where the Holy Quran starts the story of Prophet Salih. He had his people invited, the people of Thamud, and the Holy Quran started by saying, and the Thamud people belied the messengers. كَذَّبَتْ ثَمُودُ الْمُرْسَلِينَ. But their brother Salih says to them, will you not fear Allah? أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. And he introduces himself, I am unto you a trustworthy messenger, and I do not ask you any recompense in أَجْرِيَ إِلَّا عَلَىٰ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. My recompense is only from the Lord of the worlds, and I'm not looking, I'm emphasizing on this fact, that I'm not looking for any material benefits. I'm only looking for your goodness, your prosperity, for the pleasure of the Almighty Allah. And then he starts to criticize them. أَتُتْرَكُونَ فِي مَا هَا هُنَا آمِنِينَ. Will you be left secure in the enjoyment of all you have here, فِي جَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونٍ, in the gardens and springs? So, one point that we understand here is that when the bounties of security, finance and welfare are not enriched with the obedience from the Immaculate Imam, they work as a preparation for mischief and corruption. All these blessings they had, but they did not listen to the prophet of their lords. They belied him. This is what we must take notice from. إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَةً, the Holy Quran says.
نُورٌ عَلَى مَرِّ الزَّمَانِ تَأَلَّقَا وَأَضَاءَ لِي We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In
this
series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So they had so many blessings, the Holy Quran says. في جنات وعيون وزروع ونخل طلعها هضيم. But the point is that human beings are not free in front of the divine bounties. They are given these blessings and bounties, but they have some responsibilities before them. That is why, in this verse, the Holy Quran refers to the sensitive point of their life. And in a court procedure, through their inner sense, their prophet condemns them. أَتُتُرَكُونَ فِيمَا هَاهُنَا آمِنِينَ. Will you be left secure in the enjoyment of all that you have left here? في جنات وعيون, in your gardens and your springs. So he asks them whether they imagine that they will remain safe and sound fully in that secure buildings they have built. He asks them whether they imagine they will be in the ocean of bounties forever. Do they think that this material, this negligent life is eternal? Do they think that they will not encounter death, revenge, or retribution? أَتُتُرَكُونَ فِيمَا هَاهُنَا آمِنِينَ. This is how the Prophet warns them. Each of the stories of the Prophets had a particular kind of criticize in them. This is how Prophet Saleh criticizes his own people, people of Thamud. أَتُتُرَكُونَ فِيمَا هَاهُنَا آمِنِينَ. So he explains his previous sentence in details now. في جنات وعيون, he asks them whether they think that they will live eternally in these gardens, in these springs, in these lands that produce sweet, pleasant fruits. So the verse says, في جنات وعيون, in the gardens and springs. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Imam Khomeini's viewpoint on condition of leadership. Such understanding that the governmental powers of the Holy Prophet were more than those of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, or that the government authorities of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali, should be more than those of the jurist, is just wrong. Of course, the moral qualities of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny, is universally the best, and then those of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali. However, being in the highest rank of moralities does not increase one's governmental powers. Allah, who had given such authorities to the Prophet and the infallible Imams, like mobilizing and calling up the armed forces, assigning rulers and mayors, collecting taxes and spending them on the basis of Muslims' common interest, had given the same authorities to this very government, with only one difference, that he did not recognize a certain person for such a post, but gave a general title for it, which is the just Islamic jurist.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, this is Ali. And we're with you with a series of shows on the spring of truth. We are bringing some statements from Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, and explain those statements of him to you, dear brothers and sisters. Imam rahmatullah alayhi says, again, with regard to the government and the importance of the governments, he says, when the government became a just government and the government served the people, the shadow of this government is on the hearts of the people, and such a government can rule over the people. We have already said that one of the goals of the establishment of the governments is to bring justice, is to spread justice among the people, among the societies and nations and communities. So all the divine prophets came to establish a government based on justice. So Imam actually emphasizes this important goal, which has been referred to again in Quran in many ayahs and verses, that a government should bring justice to people, and this government should be at the service of the people. It's not that the people should be at the service of the government.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi.
If there was a government that could bring this justice to people, or at least make people close to that desired justice, that then the shadow of this government would stay on the hearts of the people. That is, the people will be loving this government rather than they are obliged to tolerate that government. And such a government would be a successful one. So this is actually the art of the governments, to govern on the hearts of the people rather than the bodies of the people. This beautiful point has been taken from the speeches of Imam Rahmatullah Ali.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Already in 2023, 30 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea as they attempted to reach the EU, according to figures from the United Nations. The EU's border and coast guard agency, Frontex, has in the past been lambasted for pushing back unsafe boats, resulting in deaths. On Thursday, the new head of the agency vowed to end this practice.
I am responsible for the fact that my people don't participate in anything called a pushback. So I think that is absolutely clear. That is the legal framework I work in. So that's it.
According to OLAF, the EU's anti-fraud office, at least 2,000 refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea during 2020 and 2021 as they were pushed back from the EU coastline by Frontex. The agency prevented at least 40,000 asylum seekers from reaching the EU, which blatantly breaks international law. In just 10 months, the EU has welcomed more than 4 million Ukrainian refugees. They are afforded all the same rights as EU citizens. However, if you're from a different part of the world, torn up by Western powers, it's a different story. We visited a shelter for Afghans in Brussels.
Before we come in the Europe, we think the Europe care about women, care about children. Now we come in here, not. They don't care about women, they don't care about children.
When the children go to school, they need food, they need clothes. And for everything, we need to work, so we need the job permit.
There are no such problems for Ukrainians. Of course, that's to be welcomed, but rights groups are asking why the discrimination. EU Home Affairs ministers will meet in Stockholm, Sweden next Thursday to agree on a more effective strategy to deport asylum seekers who don't meet refugee status criteria. Campaigners point out there are no plans to adopt a similar policy for refugees arriving here from Western Ukraine, arguably a relatively safe region. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Could the UK witness a renewed push by religious communities to remove a controversial relationship and sex education, also known as RSE lessons, in British schools? It appears the appetite is huge after an online petition on the UK government website rocketed to well over 130,000 signatures in just a few days.
The petition focuses on tackling just one aspect of RSE, which many parents find concerning, LGBT relationship education, which is a lifestyle not condoned by the three Abrahamic faiths. However, there is a growing anti-RSE movement, which is campaigning for the total removal of RSE from the state curriculum, as activists believe that it is parents who should be teaching their kids about this sensitive subject matter rather than state-funded teachers.
RSE is currently mandatory in British schools, teaching kids about relationships and sex education, including same-gender relations. The lessons have been marred with controversy, sparking Muslim-majority parent protests as far back as 2019. Parents alleged their kids were being indoctrinated by secular worldviews and what they call LGBT propaganda.
We believe that, you know, that the subjects, they should be able to withdraw from this type of subject. So we, the No Outsiders campaign, so we just want to be able to have control over what they are being taught.
Speaking to a local Muslim activist, Shakil Afsar explained why he feels the petition received so much support.
I think it would have got a lot more signatures if there wasn't this pro-LGBT narrative in our society where if you speak against them, you are completely shut down, locked up, and the keys thrown away. I think there would have been a lot more. And I think with the people who have signed, they are people who are at the forefront of understanding what's happening. There are many people who don't really understand the situation. They don't even really know what's happening until their children are coming home with these books. I believe that if there was a transparent media, this petition would have signatures in the millions.
So far, the protests have largely received negative coverage, with the establishment refusing to budge on the RSE curriculum. Activists believe this uncompromising stance could boil over to more parent protests in 2023. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis are growing frustrated with the United Nations' failure to condemn the Saudi-led war on Yemen, or to hold them responsible for the ensued disastrous ramifications. This comes just days after the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, addressed the United Nations Security Council about the situation in Yemen. While calling for an end to violence, Grundberg declined to condemn the ongoing Saudi artillery shelling that has killed or injured dozens of civilians in the northern province of Saada.
I call on the parties to respect international humanitarian law. Military activity, combined with negative rhetoric and escalatory political and economic measures, create a situation where a simple miscalculation could reignite a cycle of violence that will be difficult.
Grundberg also called for humanitarian aid to Yemen, but mentioned nothing about the lifting of the Saudi blockade, which is the main obstacle preventing vital aid and food supplies from entering the country. This military general we spoke with on the streets of the Yemeni capital says the United Nations is the root cause of all evil in Yemen.
The UN destroys every country they get involved in. Look at what they did in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. As for Yemen, the United Nations and all of its envoys' efforts in Yemen have been directed at spying on Yemenis, instigating conflicts among Yemenis and fueling chaos and instability.
Some Yemenis are calling on their government to abandon all political talks with the UN. They accuse the UN of complicity with the Saudi-led coalition in the killing of Yemenis. The Yemeni government stated that if the blockade is not lifted and salaries are not paid, the only option left is war.
The Yemeni people and government have expressed that the 8-year Saudi-imposed siege on Yemen must be broken by any means necessary. This after years of failed political efforts to resolve the conflict by the United Nations, an entity which most Yemenis lost trust in and accuse of supporting the Saudi military aggression on Yemen. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Tehran has hosted the first International Congress on Influential Women. The 2-day event is underway in the Iranian capital with the participation of influential, active, and elite women from almost 90 world countries. Addressing the Congress, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi called on the participating women at the Congress to benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to women's rights.
We hope that the participants of this Congress, through cooperation and interaction, will be able to take necessary measures for the rights of women in the world and benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the field of protecting women's rights and paying special attention to women's role in the society. I hope this Congress will prepare the ground for further cooperation among countries in this field.
The event is aimed at identifying, supporting and developing the abilities and capabilities of elite and influential women at national and international level.
Women are suffering worldwide. This is just because we have not been together. And most importantly, this is the very first time for the Islamic country of Iran to host such a big occasion. So I am so happy to be here, and I hope the relationship with our sisters, women in the world, we should work hard, very strongly, and look forward to the international world to assist women than ever before.
It is extremely important to integrate women in peace-building process. So this conference is extremely important because we know that we have a peace threatened in many parts of the world. And when we look for solutions, women should be involved.
Special awards with international recognition are slated to be granted to influential women in three fields of science and technology, economic and social affairs.
The Congress International of the Women, it's very important for the women in the Islam. For the development, the communication, the country, for example, Algeria, the woman Algeria and the woman Iraq, and we take the relation very important because the Islam, it's number one.
The influential women have been selected from among housewives, women employees, female social activists, as well as competent women in digital technology, social media, science and technology, entrepreneurship, and those who are pioneers in areas of culture and charity affairs.
On the sidelines of the Congress, a memorandum of understanding was signed among Afghanistan's neighboring countries at the initiative of Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs to help Afghan girls and women continue their education. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The heads of the main EU institutions defended the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy during a debate in the European Parliament on Wednesday. They insisted that sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro, is the only way to thwart Russia. Most lawmakers agree, but not all.
We see militarization, we see escalation. We are not really seeing a call for peace. We assume it will be the people who suffer the cost of sanctions.
Interest rates continue to rise in the eurozone and inflation remains extremely high. Sanctions against Moscow and the rapid move away from Russia's energy are the main reasons.
The cost of the living crisis affecting our European citizens unfortunately persists, and we are therefore concerned that the European Council conclusions fail to prioritise the support for our citizens.
Experts warn public support in the EU for the seemingly never-ending cash flow to Ukraine will eventually wane if the war persists, resulting in political consequences.
There can be a kind of danger, which is already looming, that very populistic parties, they can use this as an argument to say, look, this is something we have to cater for our own needs first, and then we have to see what's going to happen in Ukraine.
In an unprecedented departure from diplomacy on Wednesday, the European Council President Charles Michel accused authorities in Iran of operating a, quote, brutal regime. He says more sanctions against Tehran will be announced on Monday. Some lawmakers oppose the policy.
The EU and its partners never stop violating international law, going above multilateral institutions like the UN with their own parallel systems, including punishing millions of people around the world through our authoritarian unilateral sanction regime.
By insisting that rioters in Iran are peaceful protesters and by attempting to directly implicate the Islamic Republic in the Ukraine war, impartial analysts say the EU is being opportunistic, suggesting the new sanctions are trumped up and politically motivated. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
From hero to zero, and claps don't pay the bills. Some of the chants by nurses here and across the country on strike again in a dispute with government over not just pay, but patient safety. Emma has been a nurse for more than three decades.
for a long time we've felt we haven't been able to give the care we want to give because we're so pressed for time, resources, simply just numbers on the ground. So I think for a long time we've wanted things to change, and it's come to the point where this something has to change, and this is really our only option. Nothing else is working.
The reason behind that, more than 10 years of underfunding and neglect.
Across the country, the health service has been facing what's been described as an intolerable and unbearable strain due to a combination of COVID, the seasonal flu, and staff shortages, with some patients having to wait up to 24 hours for a bed inside a hospital such as this one.
That plus a record 7 million patients on the NHS waiting list, described as a national scandal. The Royal College of Nursing Union demanded a 19% pay rise when they first went on strike last year, but has since cut that in half. Yet a deal is yet to be reached. The Health Secretary, James Cleverly, says the strikes put patients' lives at risk. Last week, the government introduced legislation that, if passed, will enable employers to sue unions and fire employees if they refuse to work on strike days.
Rather than talking about the pay negotiation, talking about safer staffing and the safety and quality of care that we're giving up and down the country in our hospitals, the government have gone down this sort of anti-strike, anti-trade union route. So once again, so it's interesting to talk about safe staffing levels on a strike day, but what about the other 365 days in the year when we have not enough nurses on duty, not enough doctors, not enough physiotherapists, cancellations of operations and delayed chemotherapy? What about those days? What about safer staffing on a normal NHS day?
The UK has been hit by months of public sector strikes from rail to mail, all of whom say they're in for the long haul. In the weeks ahead, more strikes are planned by nurses, paramedics, and ambulance drivers, with the Royal College of Nursing warning it'll be their biggest walkout yet if pay talks with the government do not progress soon. Sai Purza, London.
Gaza, the symbol of resistance. This is the title of the conference held in Tehran. Attended by Iranian officials and members of Palestinian resistance groups, the event seeks to shed light on Palestinian suffering under more than seven decades of Israeli occupation, with Gaza bearing the title of an icon for the struggle for freedom.
Gaza, the 360 square kilometer, besieged over 17 years maybe, and with this dire situation, the people over there were managed to steadfast, to confront the continuous aggressions and offensive from the Israeli forces against our civilians, against our common people in Gaza.
The event is held on the anniversary of the 22-day resistance in the Gaza Strip in late 2008 and early 2009, where Palestinians resisted Israel's military offensive.
Today was the day that in Iran we remember the resistance of the Palestinian people in Gaza district after the invasion of the Israeli troops in 2008. On that year, the Israeli troops invaded oppressed people of the Palestinian in Gaza district. And in Iran, every year we remember that.
This year's edition of the annual conference seeks to recognize late Iranian General Qasem Soleimani's role in strengthening the resistance axis in Palestine.
When we talk about freedom, when we talk about resistance, when we talk about Palestine, you cannot miss the name of Shahid Soleimani. Shahid Soleimani is a big icon for us in Palestine and resistance movement to defend our own legitimate right. Shahid Soleimani was a big brother to us.
General Soleimani was killed along with his fellow comrades in January 2020 near Baghdad International Airport in a drone strike launched by the U.S. The Iranian military commander spearheaded major operations in Syria and Iraq that led to the defeat of Daesh and recapturing of key areas from the terror group.
People here say General Soleimani was a key element in the resistance.